fix your thoughts on Jesus, please. Then he cried, come, in a loud voice, and we heard the sharp sound of something hitting a china bowl there in the room and falling onto the floor. Soon we saw what it was, a revolver bullet. Five more times, the professor called out, come, and on each occasion other bullets fell one by one until there were six of them on the floor. The professor asked whose bullets they were, and Mr. Satius picked them up and examined them. They look like the ones from my revolver, he said, but they can't be, because it's locked up in a drawer. No sooner had he spoken when a revolver fell loudly onto the floor in front of our eyes. Mr. Satius recognized it at once as his own, inexplicably transported from its locked drawer. He bent down, picked it up, and was amazed to find that there were no bullets in the chamber, whereas there should have been six. At this point, amid general expressions of astonishment, Fenelon tried to persuade Myra Beely, who was sweating profusely and had turned pale, to have a rest or take a bath. But the professor did not seem to hear him, and with a jerk he suddenly slumped into a chair, staring vaguely at the ceiling. Fenelon realized he had gone into a trance. Then, Fenelon continued, he got to his feet as if drawn by an outside force, and drew our attention to an object that was passing over our heads towards the master bedroom. This was connected by a door to the room we were in. We all ran into the next room, and the first thing we saw was Mrs. Satius, who was weeping and pointing to the bedside table, crying, look! My Saint Anthony has come back! Here he is! There was indeed a statue of Saint Anthony on the bedside table, and according to Mrs. Satius it had disappeared more than 8 years previously. This was the object that had passed over our heads, on its way back to its original position. They went back into the living room, and a few moments later Myra Beely called out the word Schmidt. Long barrel, black handle. They all joined hands again, and Myra Beely led them back into the bedroom, opening a drawer with one hand, while Mr. Satius held the other, and producing a brand new Schmidt revolver, with a long barrel and black Bakelite handle. This he handed to Mr. Satius and told him to keep it. Myra Beely then sat down again and asked who was in the habit of making up his bed. The maids see to that, Satius replied. Why do you ask? I wanted to know, Myra Beely explained, so as to be able to tell you that what we are about to see is not the work of your maids. Nobody understood what he was talking about, but Myra Beely called for a knife, and going back into the bedroom he pulled the sheets and blankets aside and thrust the knife into the center of the mattress, prodding around with its point until it was heard to strike something metallic sounding. Ah! He said, here it is. Whereupon he put his hands inside the mattress and pulled out an old pair of scissors with both blades broken. I just wanted you to know that this was not put here by your maid, he observed. You can throw it away, it's no longer any use, especially for sleeping on. It was still early in the morning, and the party had not even had breakfast. As they went into the dining room, Myra Beely asked for a bottle of water. Explaining that he was receiving instructions to fluidify it, he began to make passes over it with his hands. Look! Somebody exclaimed. The water is turning pink. We were surprised to see, said Fenelon, that the water really was becoming discolored. After that episode, the party set off to visit the farm belonging to Mr. Satius's son-in-law, Jose Maria. Fenelon takes up the story. When we got there, we didn't even have time to sit down. Jose Maria introduced us to members of his family, including his own son-in-law, a boy of about 20, telling us in confidence that he had been showing suicidal tendencies. The professor at once went into one of the bedrooms, reached behind a wardrobe and pulled out a dusty picture, all covered with cobwebs. Apostrophe, whose picture is that? The professor asked. Apostrophe, that's my late brother-in-law, Jose Maria replied. He committed suicide. Apostrophe, exactly, and that's why the boy wants to do the same. You must pray hard for him and for your brother-in-law, so that he doesn't stay attached to him, influencing him without meaning to with ideas of suicide. Then Myra Beely turned to me and said, Fenelon, put your hand on the boy's head, set your thoughts and don't move. He left us and went into another room some distance away. I could hear him talking loudly at the other end of the house, and thinking something interesting might be happening that I didn't want to miss, I took my hand off the boy's head, telling him to stay where he was and think of Jesus. But I hadn't taken more than two or three steps when I heard the professor call out finally, "Get back." Although we were in rooms far apart and there was no way he could be watching me. At that moment, Fenelon later learned, a plaster sent from the nearby chapel had been flung against Myra Bealey's legs, giving him a cut that took 10 days to heal properly. Fenelon felt himself to blame for this, by disobeying orders and taking his hand off the boy's head. But Myra Bealey was in high spirits as the group sat down to lunch, in spite of the damage to his leg. He seemed to regard this as all part of the occupational hazards of his job. While we were eating, Fenelon continued, "Something passed over our heads at tremendous speed and went into the next room. Then came a deafening crash. The professor immediately got up and we all followed him into the next room, where there was nobody else at the time. We saw the lid of a water cooler wobbling around on top of the table, amid the shattered remains of the cooler itself, which was in pieces after spilling its water all over the table. We were still admiring this phenomenon when something heavy fell at the professor's feet. Jose Maria stared at it and exclaimed, "But that's my revolver." "But how on earth?" "It was safely put away inside its cover." He picked it up, examined it and confirmed that it was indeed his. Just then, something hit the professor on the back and fell to the floor. It was the cover of Jose Maria's revolver. No more, no less. After lunch, the group went back to the center of Iba! And sat down on benches in the little town's main square. But Myra Bealey, for all the entertainment he had already provided in two different houses, neither of which he had visited previously, was still not through for the day. Suddenly, Fenelon went on, rifle bullets began to fall to the ground, one after the other. Jose Maria stared at them and said they must come from his farm, because he had a store of bullets of the same caliber. Next, another object came floating out of nowhere and landed at our feet. It was a pen, which Jose Maria also recognized as his. "Apostrophe, that's right," said the professor, "this pen was brought here so that we can sign the minutes this evening." Fenelon himself wrote out this account of his memorable outing with Myra Bealey, which he signed and presented to the IBPP. Myra Bealey's reported feats make an interesting comparison with those of the 19th century medium D.D. Home, as painstakingly recorded by Sir William Crookes. 4. Crookes divided the phenomena he had personally witnessed into 13 classes. These were the production of sounds, alteration of weight of bodies, movements of heavy substances at a distance, levitation of objects and human beings, movement of objects without contact with any person, luminous appearances, materialization of hands, forms and faces and miscellaneous phenomena such as accordions playing themselves and bells ringing. The other class was of instances that, as Crookes put it, seemed to point to the agency of an exterior intelligence. No scientist of Crookes's stature has ever made such thorough studies of so many different phenomena, and his findings deserve attention by anybody seriously interested in such things. Desperate efforts have been made in recent times to discredit Crookes, claiming that he was having an affair with his favorite medium, Florence Cook, and wrote a lot of rubbish in an attempt to cover up his behavior. This I find unlikely, since Crookes was devoted to his wife Nellie, who was usually present at his sessions, held in his own house, and remained on good terms with Florence after her marriage. Since much of Crookes's research was carried out with other mediums, notably Kate Fox and Daniel Home, should we assume he was having affairs with them as well? Or was the poor fellow simply soft in the head? More than one scientist has suggested to me that this may have been the case. Let us look at some facts. Crookes's research into what he called the phenomena of spiritualism was restricted to the years 1870-1874, at which time he was at the height of his career. He turned 40 in 1872. True, his greatest discovery, that of thallium, was behind him, But over the 45 years after his psychical research period, his record does not read like that of a madman. He became president of the Chemical Society, 1887, the Institution of Electrical Engineers, 1890, the British Association, 1898, the Society of Chemical Industry, 1913, and finally the Royal Society itself, 1913. He was knighted in 1897 and awarded Britain's highest civil honor, the Order of Merit, in 1910. At the age of 86, he produced a paper for the Royal Society on the arc spectra of scandium. If he did go soft in the head, he left it extremely late. I mention all this to make the point that Myra Beely did very little that has not been witnessed elsewhere by a man with far more professional qualifications than any other psychical researcher in history. A historical precedent is as useful in psychical research as in a court of law. All the same, if anybody of Crookes's stature had investigated Myra Beely, I doubt if anybody would have believed him, just as few believed Crookes. As a contemporary of his observed, either the facts must be admitted to be such as are reported, or the possibility of certifying facts by human testimony must be given up. Resisting the temptation to give up, I will end by summarizing what I consider the best evidence available for and against Myra Beely. There is plenty of both. The largest quantity of evidence against, if not the best, comes from the newspaper Corriere Paulistano, which ran a series of diatribes against Myra Beely and everything he stood for in almost every issue from May to July 1916. They are notable for the almost total absence of any evidence in his favor, and can hardly be considered balanced or convincing. Their main theme is that Myra Beely refused to take part in experiments of the anonymous author's devising, and to judge from the tone of the articles, one can hardly blame him. Theodore Besterman's long report on his August 1934 visit to Brazil contains allegations of outright fraud, and does at least give examples of incidents he witnessed himself that he reckoned were faked. He states that he saw Myra Beely throw various small objects around the room after distracting everybody's attention by making them look at the ceiling. He also accuses Myra Beely's wife of being an accomplice in an act that involved the discovery of flowers draped around a chandelier in another room. Since she had left the room while her husband was making a speech, this does seem circumstantially possible. Some rather feeble bottle clinking went on in the dark. Spectacles moved on a table, a ruler was pulled from Besterman's hand and some paper torn while he was holding it. All this, he concluded, must be done by the use of threads, although notwithstanding every effort he never found any. Next, a coin was made to appear in a pocket of Besterman's choice. Dropping coins in people's pockets is no harder than picking them, but as Dr. Dingwall pointed out, what would have happened if Besterman had asked for the coin to appear in the heel of his shoe? 5.6. Then we come to what Besterman describes as the only really impressive part of the sittings he attended. Myra Beely took a blackboard measuring about 70 by 80 centimeters, 1 centimeter thick and weighing 3.65 kilos, and placed it on top of a bottle. A group of sitters, including the medium himself, then held their hands over the board, which after a minute or two began to revolve, turning about 1.5 full circles before it fell off the bottle. On a second attempt, at another session, the board made 3 whole revolutions before falling, and the phenomenon was repeated with a cane 60 centimeters long. All of this took place in a brilliant light, though not brilliant enough to enable Besterman to get good results with his sign camera, which Myra Beely allowed him to use without objection. Besterman tried later to repeat the board revolving effect by blowing, and found he could not. He was satisfied at least on this occasion that no threads were used, and admits that any other fraudulent method is difficult to conceive. Finally, Besterman was treated to a display of Myra Beely's skill at automatic writing. He records that the medium produced just under 1,800 words in French in 53 minutes, giving an average of 34 words per minute. This is not bad going. I can write 50 words in a minute in my own language, but I could not keep it up for 53 minutes, and I could certainly not do so in French, although unlike Myra Bealey I have a university degree in that language. Yet Besterman finds nothing difficult, let alone paranormal, about this feat. He sums up his findings as follows: he is either a fraud pure and simple, or else he possesses a certain narrowly defined paranormal faculty, round which he has erected, for commercial purposes, an elaborate structure of fraud. There did appear to be, he admitted, a prima facie case for the second possibility, subject to numerous reservations. Later, as we shall see, he changed his mind. Besterman's evidence is inconclusive, but since it is just about all we have of its kind, it deserves some study. He does at least suggest that Myra Bealey cheated on occasions, though this is no proof at all that he always did. It may be that Myra Bealey was anxious to put on a good show for his foreign visitor, and that he appeared to help out the genuine phenomena with a few wholly normal ones. Yet the question of fraudulent mediumship is a lot more complicated than it may seem to some, including Besterman. You simply cannot catch mediums cheating just once and then denounce them as total phonies. Take the case of Eusapia Palladino. This astonishing Neapolitan convinced experienced researchers over and over again that inexplicable phenomena could and did take place in her presence. She also convinced practically everybody who attended her sessions that she would appear to cheat shamelessly whenever she could. Yet when Everard Fielding investigated her, in 1908, under almost ideal conditions, he found that the tighter the controls, the less she cheated and the more genuine phenomena she caused to take place. As his two co-investigators Hayard Carrington and Wortley Baggerly, both experts in magic and trickery, agreed. William James has pointed out that for fraud in any form to exist, there must have been a genuine original. He confesses that he once cheated himself, by projecting the shadow of a turtle onto a screen during a physiology lecture, showing its heart apparently beating. The turtle was in fact dead, and the movement of its heart was caused by James's finger. Should everything he wrote since be discredited because of this? 8. Myra Bealey may well have performed a few simple conjuring tricks now and then, perhaps not knowing what he was doing. There is plenty of evidence to suggest that mediums cheat without consciously knowing they are doing so. But to claim Myra Bealey was totally fraudulent, as Besterman did, see below, seems unreasonable. To prove such a claim, it is necessary to show or at least suggest how he did everything he was thought to do, and Besterman admits he cannot explain even the few phenomena he witnessed himself. One is reminded of Crookes's reply to his critics: prove it to be an error by showing where the error lies, or, if a trick, by showing how the trick is performed. Try the experiment fully and fairly. If fraud be found, expose it; if it be a truth, proclaim it. This is the only true scientific procedure, and this it is that I purpose steadily to pursue. Besterman duly exposed some fraud, but he was never able to show how the blackboard trick was done. However, nearly 40 years later he was able to tell me in a letter that what I do remember very clearly was that Myra Bealey left me in no doubt that he was purely and simply fraudulent. Once I had expressed this opinion, he added, none of his followers would talk to me, so that I was unable to get any first-hand impression of their role in his performance. 9. In fairness to Besterman, it must be said that little useful research can be done in 2 or 3 weeks in Brazil even today, and even when one speaks Portuguese, as I do and he did not. In 1934 there was a strong tide of nationalism in Brazil in the wake of the 1930 revolution, and even if Besterman had interviewed witnesses before denouncing Myra Bealey, which might have been worth trying, I doubt if they would have immediately described their personal experiences to an unknown foreigner. Enormous patience and very careful handling of sensibilities are called for if one is to get anything out of Brazilian spiritists. There is a very curious discrepancy between Besterman's published account of the 5 special meetings Myra Bealey held for his benefit and the official minutes of the same meetings, which Eureka Dagos prints in full in his book. At the very first meeting, according to the minutes, Myra Bealey announced that he could see an entity named Zabel, whom he described in detail. Besterman said he had known a lady of that name in London who was now dead, and when he asked for a sign of her presence, bottles began to jump around on a table, one of them even falling onto the floor at his request. Besterman mentions the bottles, but not the mysterious Zabel. At the second meeting, Zabel again dropped in and became visible enough for Dr. Thade de Medeiros to take a photograph of her. This is reproduced in Dagoz's book, and is one of the more credible materialization photographs I have seen. The lady is not even wearing an Arab headdress, for once, according to the minutes, which Dagoz reports Besterman as having signed. Zabel performed a number of feats to prove her presence. In the minutes of the third meeting, we are told that Besterman examined the photograph of Zabel and declared that there was a strong resemblance to the lady he had known. The face on the photograph is extremely clear, more so than in most pictures of this kind. It is surprising that Besterman makes no mention of this episode. It is clear from his lengthy published report that he was anxious to miss no opportunity to discredit Myra Beeley's powers, and if the Zabel story were untrue, here was an excellent opportunity to do so. If, on the other hand, it was true, then Besterman is guilty of suppressing strong evidence in favor of the medium. As so often happens, an attempt to investigate paranormal phenomena led to raising more doubts instead of solving any problems. Next, we turn to the brief but meticulously presented evidence of Professor Hans Driesch, who, as I have already mentioned, was the most distinguished foreigner ever to see Myra Beeley in action. Driesch met him on a brief visit to São Paulo in August 1928. His impressions were contained in a 5-page letter he wrote to an SPR colleague some 3 months later. This letter has never been published, and I am most grateful to the Council of the SPR for allowing me to quote from it here, for the first time. Myra Beeley, says Driesch, was quite a nice and jolly fellow, of an Italian or Spanish type, although he surprised the multilingual German embryologist by claiming not to understand Italian, which was certainly not true. There followed, however, a long discourse in Italian, which Driesch found very indifferent, purporting to come from the spirit of Myra Beeley's deceased father. After this unimpressive start, Myra Beeley's performance improved somewhat when a mirror fell from a table with nobody less than 6 feet from it, a bottle moved and fell over in another room, and a metal pot did the same thing in the kitchen. There was also a vase with flowers, Driesch writes. All the flowers fell to the ground, one of them moved towards Mrs. Driesch. An enormous knife also fell to the ground, but most impressive of all was a double door that closed itself in response to Myra Beeley's appeal to one of his favorite saints for a sign. Driesch made it clear that conditions were not scientific, but he was undoubtedly impressed by what he saw. The phenomena had taken place in the private house of a German banker, who is personally beyond all doubts, in a good light, and though they were trivial stuff compared to almost any of the sessions described by Eurico Dagoz, they were enough for Driesch to invite Myra Beeley to visit Europe to be investigated properly. Myra Beeley agreed at once, provided he could take his wife and his friend Dagoz with him. He did not demand a fee. However, the project fell through, and the only further contact Myra Beeley was to have with the SPR was through the inconclusive investigations of Theodore Besterman already described. A great opportunity was lost, but at least we have evidence that Myra Beeley could be found impressive by a former president of the society. 10. Now we consider the best published evidence available for the defense of Myra Beeley, which comes from a wholly unexpected quarter. The late Carlos Imbassi, one of the most widely respected pillars of Orthodox Brazilian Spiritism and author of A Monumental History of Psychical Phenomena that appeared in 1935.11, the 377 footnotes scattered through the pages of this well-written book show that its author was thoroughly familiar with psychical research in Britain, France and the US. Though he has nothing to say about research in Brazil for the simple reason that there had never been any. He does, however, devote 4 pages to Myra Beeley, making it quite clear at the start that he strongly disapproved of the man and had no desire at all even to meet him. As a highly orthodox spiritist, Imbassi regarded Myra Beeley as either a vulgar fraud, a skillful conjurer, or at most a medium who had got mixed up in the wrong company, both incarnate and discarnate. Worst of all, everything seemed to get smashed up when he was around, and Imbasa-e had no wish to get involved in this perilous mediumship. One day, Imbasa-e, who had made his opinion of Mirabili well known to his friends, was at home with a businessman friend called Daniel de Brito, when who should turn up out of the blue but Mirabili himself. He had been brought along by another friend of Imbasa-e's who was convinced of the medium's genuineness. "I must have looked like a farmer who has just seen a swarm of locusts on the horizon," he writes. A member of the household was ill at the time, and there was nobody I less wanted to see. Mirabili nevertheless made himself at home at once, seating himself in a rocking chair and promptly launching into a speech in detestable Italian mixed with Portuguese and Spanish words. This purported to come from Cesare Lombroso, and Imbasa-e sat through it, deciding that the medium was a grotesque charlatan, but consoling himself with the thought that at least his crockery was still intact on the shelves. Upon finishing his speech, Mirabili immediately turned to Brito and proceeded to give the startled businessman an account of his life from the cradle onwards. Brito had never met him before, and was not a well-known figure himself, but the medium seemed to know all there was to know about him. Imbasa-e was reluctantly impressed. "Once more, I began to worry about the fate of my plates," he adds. Next, upon hearing that there was a sick person in the house, Mirabili called for some bottles of water, which a housemaid brought in and placed on a table 4 or 5 meters from where he was sitting. He never touched them, and the four men joined hands to form a current, so as to help the spirits fluidify the water. Immediately, in full view of us all, Imbasa-e writes, one of the bottles rose halfway up the height of the others, and hit them with full force for 5 or 10 seconds, before returning to its place. We thought they must have been cracked. This was clearly seen and heard, with no shadow of hesitation. People in the next room also heard it, and the patient became extremely alarmed. So did everybody else, as Mirabili then announced that a phalange of obsessing spirits had arrived. "Oh Lord," Imbasa-e thought, "there goes the glassware." But at that point, the patient leapt out of bed and begged them to end the session, which they did accordingly. Mirabili left soon afterwards. Imbasa-e slumped exhausted and sweating into an armchair, though relieved that his precious crockery had survived intact. The patient, incidentally, got worse at once. As consolation, he concludes, we were left with the unshakable certainty of Mirabili's mediumistic gifts. Trickery was out of the question. Nobody had touched the bottles except the maid. The room was lit by 2 100-watt bulbs, and there had been no time for Mirabili to prepare any tricks. His hands had been held while the bottles moved and he had been far back from the table. Against his previous judgment, Imbasa-e concluded that Mirabili was a medium after all, though not one that he ever wanted to have in the house again. There are 3 possible verdicts on Mirabili. One is that he was a total fraud. The second is that he was one of the greatest mediums of all time, capable of producing almost every mental or physical paranormal effect known to psi research. The third verdict is that he had the unknown power as few have ever had it. But he did not fully understand it or make proper use of it. On his off days, which mediums have like anybody else, he was capable of producing some innocuous conjuring tricks, perhaps unconsciously, in order not to disappoint his audience. This is the verdict I prefer. There is insufficient evidence for the first two, though there is far more in favor of the second than the first. However, evidence came to light in 1990 that Mirabili was party to deliberate deception on at least one occasion. Earlier, I mentioned the photograph that purports to show him in midair. This was reproduced for the first time outside Brazil, as far as I know, in the first edition of this book, and I noted in my original caption that the author is unable to authenticate the photo and that it could have been faked. An original print discovered in the archives of the Society for Psychical Research shows clear signs of fakery in the form of retouching to remove the ladder on which Mirabili was standing. The print is signed by Myra Bealey and inscribed to Mr. Theodore Besterman, who surprisingly does not mention it in his report. I can hardly disagree with Gordon Stein, the American researcher who found it, that Myra Bealey knowingly passed off a fraudulent photo of himself as authentic. 12. Once a cheat, always a cheat.